This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. And this is the podcast that's designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region, and thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of January 26th, 2026. The killing of Alex Preti by ICE agents in Minneapolis has exposed a rift between the Trump administration and Second Amendment defenders over Americans' constitutional rights to protest and carry firearms. Wayne Schutzke looks at how the incident will affect protesters in Arizona and their right to bear arms as ICE comes to town.
The Department of Homeland Security's narrative of the shooting claims Preti approached U.S. Border Patrol officers with a 9mm semi-automatic handgun. And Trump administration officials branded him a domestic terrorist, even as bystander video shows Preti was clearly holding a phone, not the gun he was legally licensed to carry in the state of Minnesota, when agents surrounded him and took him to the ground. Footage also appears to show agents disarm Preti while pinning him down, just before he was shot. In comments to the press on Tuesday, President Trump blamed Preti for bringing a gun to the protest in the first place.
You can't walk in with guns. You can't do that. But it's just a very unfortunate incident.
That statement came as a shock to many of Trump's unapologetically pro-Second Amendment supporters. The president's remarks also stand in stark contrast to firearm stances historically taken by GOP politicians. The deadly shooting has caused concerns about how ICE agents will behave in Arizona, a point Attorney General Chris Mays raised in a controversial interview with 12 News that aired the week before the shooting in Minneapolis.
We have one of the most expansive stand your ground laws in the entire country that rivals even Florida. We also have a lot of guns in Arizona. We're a gun culture in this state.
Republicans have called for Mays to resign over the comments, arguing she was putting law enforcement at risk. She denied those allegations, and some Democrats say she was just explaining state law. Democratic Senator Brian Fernandez, who is a gun owner, said Preti's death shows that it may be armed Arizonans exercising their Second Amendment rights who are actually at risk as federal officials ramp up immigration raids in the valley.
Since when did exercising a constitutional right turn a patriot into a criminal in the eyes of the president? Where was this outrage in 2020 when armed citizens gathered to protest the election results or the COVID mandates? We were told they were defenders of liberty.
State Senator Priya Sundaresan, Mays' fellow Democrat, says the attorney general's comments were actually proven prescient by Preti's death.
People across the political spectrum have and bear arms, and that creates the conditions for the dangerous combustible situation that we anticipate will continue to see.
Arizona's gun laws allow most citizens over the age of 18 to openly carry a gun, and most people over 21 can conceal a firearm. And the state's gun culture crosses political lines. Over the last decade, protesters from both right and left-wing groups have openly carried assault rifles at the state capitol. Charles Heller, co-founder of the Arizona Citizens Defense League, a gun rights group, says those rights allow adults to carry guns in most situations, including protests. He says there are only a limited number of places where you can't carry a gun under state law.
You have the same rights no matter where you are.
And Heller says the government, including Trump, can't change that.
The president's comments are irrelevant. Your rights don't come from the president. You're born with your rights. The government, the purpose of Arizona's Constitution in Article 2, Section 2, is that all power is inherent in the people.
Trump's comments have also exposed a rift among Republican leaders who try to reconcile support for the president with their past support for Second Amendment rights. In Arizona, Republican officials have routinely defended or remained silent when activists brought firearms to protests. House Speaker Steve Montenegro says they will continue to defend the right to do so.
Do Arizonans have the right to carry a firearm at a protest, regardless of the content of that protest? I'm not trying to make it political, but is that a right that they have?
So we're going to continue to stand behind the people of Arizona and every one of their rights, including Second Amendment rights.
A few months ago, Senate President Warren Peterson, an ardent gun rights advocate who is running for attorney general, took to social media to say that, quote, society is safer when people exercise their right to carry. But now his answer is more nuanced.
Do Arizonans have the right to carry a firearm at a protest, regardless of what they're protesting? Just trying to remove the content of the protest away from it.
Well, if you're in a public space, yeah, I mean, you have the right to carry. That doesn't go away. What you can't do is interfere with what is happening with ICE.
He says lawmakers will defend Arizonans' constitutional rights, but that he also agrees with the president that people shouldn't bring guns to protests.
To bring a weapon to a protest, yeah, that's probably not the best idea.
In something of a role reversal, it is Democrats like Sundaration who are more unequivocal in their defense of Arizonans' right to bear arms.
But Democrats are here to say, we recognize the constitutional rights that exist in our Bill of Rights and elsewhere, and we're here to defend them.
But they are also concerned that people exercising those rights could now have a target on their back as reports roll in that federal immigration agents are increasing their presence in Arizona. Wayne Chutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In politics news, as Arizona's legislative session begins, housing affordability continues to be a priority for many lawmakers. But in an era of deep political divisions, will they be able to agree on potential solutions this year? Catherine Davis-Young headed to a construction site to find out.
Concrete foundations have been poured side by side for two new affordable homes in a West Phoenix neighborhood. A crew of volunteers with Habitat for Humanity is getting ready to work. Among them is Sarah Ligori. She's a Democrat who represents Central Phoenix in Arizona's House of Representatives. She says she doesn't have a whole lot of construction skills.
Measure zero, hang nine times, I think is my motto.
But pretty soon she has a hard hat on and a nail gun in her hand.
I want to see how a house is built. This is exciting.
She helps Republican Representative Kevin Payne frame a window for the side of one house. This is the first ever red and blue build hosted by Habitat for Humanity Central Arizona. The organization sells affordable homes to qualifying families. Volunteer construction crews are part of how they keep costs low. CEO Todd Rogers says the idea behind this event was to bring legislators from both sides of the aisle to lend a hand and literally hammer out their differences.
When we're so divided, even at our Thanksgiving tables, let's just bring people out and say, when we can build together and help a family, we're just changing the world.
But this is more than just a team-building opportunity. Rogers says these lawmakers have very real problems to solve. Arizona's population growth is outpacing construction. Wages aren't keeping up with home prices. Homelessness in the state has reached a record high, and Arizona's cost of living has now surpassed the national average.
If you're spending 50 and 60% of your income on just housing, how are you affording medical costs or groceries or any of those other necessities?
The legislative session kicked off earlier this month, and Ligori says reining in housing costs is a priority for the governor and lawmakers from both parties.
Every district around the state, one of the top three issues you hear, are my colleagues here, is that there is an affordability crisis in housing and a lack of supply and choices of housing.
More than 1,300 bills have already been introduced this session. Many relate to housing. Ligori is backing a bill to create affordable housing tax credits. Other Democrats are proposing to invest more in the state's housing trust fund and to narrow the list of reasons a landlord can evict a tenant. Meanwhile, Republican proposals include letting school districts lease land for housing and prohibiting cities from requiring costly HOAs. Republican Representative Selena Bliss is working with Habitat for Humanity on a bill to streamline the permitting process for workforce housing developers.
We all know delays and prolonged time in the construction industry means more cost. As they say, time is money.
She also wants to give municipalities more control over rules for short-term rentals. But Bliss points out with so many bills filed, there are challenges ahead.
If every other legislator is sponsoring a short-term rental bill, I think people will get confused.
The process to get a bill through committees, the House, the Senate, and onto the governor's desk is a long one. Last year, legislators said housing was a priority, but by the end of the session, they had passed few bills to address the issue.
Housing is very difficult to move the legislature, and it's not an ideological split.
Steve Kaiser is a former Republican state lawmaker. Now he has his own policy firm. He's working with Habitat for Humanity on their legislative goals. He says housing is a rare area where a lot of Republicans and Democrats could potentially find common ground.
I think where the pushback comes from is NIMBYism, frankly. People that are afraid of change, they don't want any development in their community.
The stakes continue to get higher year after year, Kaiser says.
If we don't build more housing, we will have increased increased homelessness, increased taxes, and increased home prices where your kids will not be able to live in the same state as you.
It remains to be seen which, if any, bills to alleviate the state's housing shortage will gain traction this year. At Habitat for Humanity's lawmaker volunteer event, just 3 of Arizona's 90 legislators showed up in the end. Organizers say they hope to make it an annual event, and they hope more will come out next time. Representative Ligori hopes so too.
We are at the Capitol and we talk about policy, debate policy, but until we can go out and experience it in the real world, visit the organizations and the people that the policy whose lives we're affecting, I think that brings us great insight and perspective.
She says that on-the-ground perspective is something all lawmakers need. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening.
Rio Salado College is hosting the Dash with Rio 5K and 10K Run Walk in Tempe on Saturday, April 18th. This community event welcomes runners and walkers of all levels with early bird registration for a limited time. Details at dashwithrio.com.
In environment news, let's now turn to some efforts to conserve water in our desert environment. With Arizona in drought and cuts likely coming to the state's allocation of Colorado River water, lots of people are looking for ways to conserve the water we do have, and that means folks are trying to get creative. As Mark Brody reports, 2 ASU professors think they've figured out a piece of this puzzle.
Behind the university's Macro Technology Works building in Tempe, in what looks like a very large carport, is a series of pipes, knobs, measurement tools, basins, and water. The plan at this test facility is to work out how to treat briny water that comes as a result of industrial and manufacturing processes. Basically, how to take the salt out, which leaves water that's usable for something else, although likely not drinking.
Our goal is to treat wastewater and at the same time producing more fresh water, you know, from different industrial wastewater.
That's Taijing Tong, an associate professor of environmental engineering at ASU. He and his colleague Shanwaz Sinha, an associate research professor in civil and environmental engineering at ASU, have met me here for a tour and to talk about their work. Sinha says part of the problem their research is trying to solve is one of geography.
The water that we usually get is already a little bit salty, you know, like what's coming in from the Colorado River water or from the reservoir. It's a hot, arid region, you know. And when the industries are using, like, municipal tap water, but there's many industries who wants to treat this water even more so they can get more pure and more ultra-pure water. But in the process, they're also getting a lot of salt left behind, you know.
Sinha says salt management is one of the most critical issues they're working on. Certain industries, think semiconductors or food and beverage, need water for their manufacturing processes. They don't want to have to keep using new water, but what's left when they're done isn't reusable as is. Sinha says that's where this work comes in.
We're going to convert this fab wastewater to tap water, like that is the feed water for them, and we'll convert the tap water to the ultra-high purity water, you know, and they could use it for chip manufacturing. So we're totally closing the loop, like we're taking the wastewater and we are creating ultra-high purity water, and that could be utilized for chip manufacturing. This is our idea, you know.
Through the filtration and treatment process, Sinha and Tong believe they figured out how to turn that briny water into industry-usable water. So that solves one problem, but in a sense, it creates another. What to do with all that salt they've taken out of the water?
If you are in the coastal region, you know, like in Florida or California, you know, I mean, you're creating a brine, and you could easily discharge it to the sea, you know, with some type of safety stuff, you know, but people who are in the inland, like places like Arizona, Colorado, you know, and some places they do allow deep well injection, but some places they don't, you know, so you are left with this briny wastewater, and you have to come up with an innovative way of tackling this wastewater.
Shanwaz Sinha acknowledges that's a concern. A 2006 study from the Bureau of Reclamation found at that time the Colorado, Salt, and Verde Rivers imported nearly 2 million tons of dissolved salts each year into Maricopa, Pinal, and Pima counties. And that salt comes with a financial cost, too, around $30 million each year. So while it's great to remove that salt from the water, Sinha says what happens next is also important. He says, though, there are uses for that salt.
When we were working with the food and beverage industry, this is the same question they ask, you know, like, what are you going to do? I think we have to think about in a creative way how to deal with it, you know. I mean, if you are in the Northeast region and other places, you know, you could use this salt for de-icing, you know. I mean, I just looked at some people were mentioning, you know, they also need a briny stuff to for soap manufacturing, you know. So that could be another place, you know. Sometime, you know, places like where they could use like a briny water for other type of application, you know, say for a cooling tower or other places, you know, they could also have this type of water available.
And Taijing Tong says while they're at it, when they remove the salt from the briny water, they may find some other goodies as well.
So for this pilot scale, you know, system, the major focus is to treat the brine. So basically, we turn the brine into fresh water, but at the same time, reduce the problem of water pollution. You know, however, you're right that, you know, it's a high potential that we can recover valuable elements, you know, from different wastewater.
Tong and Sinha say the plan is to put the equipment in trailers. That would make it mobile, meaning it could go where it's needed, turning briny water into usable water and salt along the way. Mark Brody, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Indigenous Affairs. A year ago Tuesday, San Carlos Apache teenager Emily Pike went missing from a Mesa group home. Her dismembered remains were discovered a month later in garbage bags more than 100 miles away. No arrests have been made nor suspects named. Earlier this month, a memorial in Mesa, marking where Emily was last seen alive, got taken down. As Gabriel Piacerazio reports, it's the latest rallying cry for justice in the 14-year-old girl's unsolved murder.
Who are we here for?
Emily Pike!
Then say her name!
Emily Pike!
Say her name!
Emily Pike!
Say her name!
At the corner of Mesa Drive and McKellips Road, dozens of demonstrators met on a recent Saturday as cars drove by honking their horns.
Justice for who?
Emily Pike!
Justice for who?
Emily Pike!
Who do we love?
Emily Pike!
Who do we love?
This is where Emily was last seen alive.
Only secrets in their diary. Girls gone missing is a national inquiry.
Since her disappearance, a chain-link fence hugging the edge of a 28,000-square-foot vacant lot has become home to a roadside memorial for the slain Apache teen. And it just kept on growing as more shared her story. Visitors from near and far have flocked to this bustling intersection, adorned with flowers, stuffed animals, a banner of Emily's face, and lots of red ribbons, each markers of MMIP, or the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Movement. That was until someone suddenly took everything down earlier this month. Those items weren't thrown away, though, but neatly placed in and around a plastic trash bin. The city of Mesa tells KJZZ it's not responsible. Phoenix-based DoubleTree Ventures, which owns the parcel and wants to turn it into a Dunkin' Donuts, did not respond when asked. No matter who did it, Jolene Shorty is still upset.
Look what you guys did. You took down her stuff. There is a respectful way. There is a traditional way to let things go. This is not the way.
Shorty and fellow Apaches traveled a few hours to the valley that weekend. Some even considered this spot sacred, burning bundles of sage and tobacco while spreading the ashes. For Shorty, she says this is the second tragedy to happen there.
But what I see here, my people, what I see here, my tribal nations, I see a clean slate to start over. In a way, they almost helped us. We're going to come back and put up more stuff. We're going to honor them the way we're supposed to.
Delvina Charlie, who is Dene, thinks taking down those mementos adds insult to injury.
This is the respect that we got. This is the respect that we as a community, as a nation, came together when a girl went missing. We're pushed to the side that our voices meant nothing, that she meant nothing. If this was a different privileged girl, it would have been handled differently.
Since the items were taken down, Emily's family has been in talks with the city of Mesa on planting a tree and placing a bench at Fitch Park, just a few blocks from her last known location. They're also in discussions with ADOT about putting up a highway sign honoring Emily at milepost 277 along US 60 near Globe, where her remains were found in the Tonto National Forest.
This girl lost her life thinking nobody cared.
Jared Marquez is San Carlos Apache and treasurer of the Turtle Island Women Warriors.
This girl lost her life wanting her family. This girl right here wanted love, wanted her mom, wanted her siblings, wanted a better life. I've been there. Being a 13-year-old kid, never talking to my parents, running around on the reservation, you know, nobody ever truly caring. And it's hard to think what this girl went through, a lot of us could have been through.
As for the investigation into Emily's murder, KJZZ asked the FBI, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Missing and Murdered Unit, and the lead agency, Gila County Sheriff's Office, for the status, but did not receive any updates. For KJZZ News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio, reporting from Mesa.
In education news, Gilbert Public Schools has decided to close one of its elementary schools due to declines in enrollment. From the education desk, Bridget Dowd reports.
The governing board voted unanimously to shut down Pioneer Elementary School, which has been around for more than 40 years. It's been the smallest elementary school in the district for the past 3 years and has the lowest space utilization. Before the vote, board member Jill Humphreys gave an emotional thank you to the staff at Pioneer for all the work they put in.
And my commitment as an individual is to continue to work hard to support our public schools where every student can attend. And I'm sorry that we have to make this decision.
The closure is expected to save the district about $2.5 million. There are no immediate plans for the future use of the building, but an administrator said they would keep the property maintained while it's not in use. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In Fronteras news, federal investigators say a Southern Arizona man shot by Border Patrol agents early Tuesday could face federal charges. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, Elisa Resnick reports.
Both federal and local authorities say their investigations are ongoing into the shooting about 35 miles south of Tucson. Heath Yonke of the FBI's Phoenix office says Patrick Gary Schlegel fled from Border Patrol agents after they tried to stop his vehicle for suspected human smuggling.
CBP agents came into contact with the subject. During the attempt to apprehend him, the subject used a firearm to shoot at a manned CBP helicopter.
Yonke says agents shot Schlegel during a foot pursuit. Authorities say he's in serious but stable condition at a Tucson hospital and could face charges, including assault on a federal officer. Pima County Sheriff Chris Nano says his department is investigating the agents' use of force. Neither he nor Yonke would say whether the agents wore body cameras. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
In science news, Arizona has confirmed 24 cases of measles so far in January. Health officials continue to urge Arizonans to take precautions against the extremely contagious disease. Catherine Davis-Young reports.
As the outbreak continues to grow, health officials are warning of potential measles exposure for anyone who visited the Hale Theater in Gilbert on several dates in early January, or anyone who visited two El Rio health clinics in Tucson in mid-January. Getting vaccinated is the best way Arizonans can protect themselves, says Dr. Richard Carmona, an advisor to the state health department. He says falling vaccination rates are to blame for the resurgence of measles.
It is really sad that we have been plagued with an epidemic of mis and disinformation, that people are uncertain of what to do and who to trust.
97% of cases in Arizona's outbreak have been among unvaccinated people. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, in original productions, let's give a listen to singer-songwriter Carl Hayes. Here's the show co-host, Sam Dingman.
As you may have heard last week on the show, I used to work at this big tech company, and I really did not fit in there. So I spent a lot of my days hiding from my coworkers and listening to music. And there is an artist I discovered back then named Hayes Carl. He had this song called Drunken Poet's Dream that I just loved. It is about living a life of gleeful recklessness and not doing what you know you should be doing just because it feels good. Something about that idea was really resonant for me back then. So I have been following Hayes Carl's music for a while now. And the more I got into his work, I realized there was something else that was drawing me to him. He was good friends with my favorite songwriter, the late Todd Snyder, who you might have also heard me talk about on the show. So for all these reasons, when I saw that Hayes Carl was coming to Phoenix this month, he will be at Crescent Ballroom this Friday, I thought I would see if he'd be willing to talk. And thankfully he was. Hayes is touring in support of his new album, We're Only Human. And when we spoke last week, I began by asking him about something I'd heard him say in another interview, that he never used to write songs to figure out what was going on with him internally, but that on this record, that had changed.
It's interesting. Last night I went to a funeral service for my friend Todd Snyder.
Oh, my goodness.
And he had always had a quote that resonated with me, which was, I don't write these songs to change anybody's mind about anything, but I write them to ease my own mind about everything.
Yes, yes.
And that had always had really resonated with me, and I appreciated it. But when I reflected upon it, I realized I wasn't necessarily doing that in my own songwriting. And I hit a certain point in my personal life, a divorce, and I just had a birthday last week and turned 50 and
happy birthday.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I had a big time. But it made me, I was a bit lost in my own life. And for the first time I started using the writing and the music to sort through some of that stuff.
Thank you for sharing all that. And I'm really glad you brought up Todd because I'm a huge fan of his as well. And I have a couple other questions for you about that for later. But one of the moments on the record where this way of thinking about songwriting really came through for me is on the song High.
I am just the right amount of high, floating between this moment and the sky, babe. Exactly at the height.
I just don't think I'd ever heard anybody express that sentiment of escaping the moment, but not quite all the way, if I heard that correctly. Yeah. Like, it's not about totally trying to disappear from reality, but just take a little distance from it.
Yeah, it was a funny one for me. I mean, admittedly, I wrote it when I was stoned, or that line came up. And so I was being quite literal when I came up with the line. I was like, oh, this is just perfect. I'm in that sweet spot of where I'm relaxed and comfortable and at ease and feeling creative and feeling present. And that's how I want my drugs to work for me. And but then I started thinking about it, and I thought it's not about the drugs. Like, that's how I go through life, is struggling to just be centered and at peace and not overwhelmed and have my monkey mind racing all the time and
yes,
ruminating on the past or being anxious about the future. And so much of my life has been less enjoyable than I would have liked it to be because of that. It's just sort of a reminder to myself, that song. It's a fun one because I'll be singing it live and I'll be anxious about something or my mind will be somewhere else and I'll hear the lyrics and I'll go, oh yeah, this was for you to come. Remember, you can come back to this place of being centered.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I hear you saying in that you're doing the Todd thing you were just referencing of singing the songs to ease your own mind.
I equate it to a snow globe. My brain, it's so much of my life, it's just been shooken up and I can't see in front of my face. And I just got tired of it, you know? And
yeah.
I finally, I think I reached a point where it's like, let's figure this out for whatever time we got left.
Yeah.
Because I've got a great life and I'd like to enjoy it more than I have been able to traditionally.
Another song where you're addressing really vulnerable emotions is I Got Away With It. And on that song, you have lyrics like, I acted like some kind of stranger when she desperately needed a friend, and I made such a mess out of all that was left, and it won't fit together again. And you said once in an interview that that song is, among other things, about not always having been the man you want to be.
Yeah, I've been married and divorced twice, and I have a lot of regrets. You know, there's that saying, we do the best we can with what we have at the time. I mean, I want to hold myself accountable and recognize where I went wrong or where I could have improved, but also have some grace for myself. And it's not me trying to beat myself up, but it is an acknowledgement of my where I fell short of who I wanted to be for other people.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you for sharing that. And it really made me think as I was listening to that song about the first song of yours I ever heard, the way I discovered your music, which I'm sure is true of many people. There's a lot of people who love this song, Drunken Poet's Dream.
Wine bottles scattered like last night's clothes. Cigarettes, papers, and diamond nose.
I realized that that was maybe at a time in your life where you weren't necessarily writing from an autobiographical place, but that song is so much about leaning into excess and indulgence. And it was interesting to me to think about the arc between the lyrics of that song and a song like I Got Away With It, which, as you were just referring to, is about rebuilding and acknowledging damage.
Yeah, I think I certainly went through a lot of life at high speed, and you know, a lot of the music I grew up on is, you know, romanticizing this debaucherous life and this drunkenness and the womanizing and the travel and the extremes of everything. And I was very drawn to that. It's very romantic, and you know, there's a lot of good times, you know, in that.
Sure. Yeah.
But it was not balanced or sustainable. And like I said, I'm much more interested these days in finding the things that I don't have to rely on outer stimuli to find happiness or peace.
I realize we're sort of making it sound like this record is like totally self-flagellating, and I want listeners to understand there is some of that, but it's not all that. And I got the sense that part of the idea behind the title, which is We're Only Human, was to encourage people not just to look at their own, you know, failings and cravings and needs through the lens that you are here, but also when they look at other people who are doing things that they don't understand or that seem just totally like reckless or stupid or foolish or whatever the case may be, to give them a little bit of grace too.
Yeah. You know, I think I'm a decent human being, and I try hard. I just don't always get it right.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask, I mean, in answering that question, you almost directly quoted a Todd Snyder song, All Right Guy. I know I ain't perfect, but Lord knows I try.
Yeah.
And one of the other things I thought about when I was listening to I Got Away With It. Is that Todd, of course, has a song called You Got Away With It.
You got away with it. You got away.
And I wondered if there was any attempt on that song to pay homage to him.
That's funny. I hadn't thought about that until you just mentioned it.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, Todd was a hero of mine. You know, one thing I loved about Todd was, among many, was his songs were not judgmental. So even his worst characters, there is a little bit of grace for him in the way that Todd put things. And I always loved that.
And that's how we got your record, We're Only Human.
Yeah.
Well, I have been speaking with Hayes Carl, whose 10th album, We're Only Human, is out now, and Hayes will be performing at Crescent Ballroom on Friday, January 30th. Hayes, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
We're to most anything to avoid the pain, hiding our hearts and casting.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Katina Foundation, Basis Charter Schools, Palo Verde Generating Station, SRP, and the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online, and on the KJZZ mobile app.